This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan describes Hilary Mantel as one of those rare writers who may no longer need an introduction. Here's Maureen's review of Mantel's new short story collection, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher.
A new Hilary Mantel book is an event with a capital E. Here's why. The first two best-selling novels in Mantel's planned trilogy about Thomas Cromwell, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, each won the Man Booker Prize. That's a first. The BBC is filming an adaptation of Wolf Hall for airing in 2015, and Mantel's original short story, The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, was printed in the Sunday New York Times Book Review a few weeks ago. That story is from Mantel's new short story collection of the same name. Heads always tend to roll, figuratively and otherwise, in Mantel's writing. Hers is a brusque and brutal world, leavened with humor. Humor that's available in one shade only, black. Even Mantel's many fans might approach this collection with some skepticism. After all, publishers have been known to cash in on an author's popularity by gathering up and repackaging earlier remnants. Indeed, 9 of these stories were published already in the UK. But I deem only one to be dispensable. It's a soft, impressionistic piece called Terminus, in which an unnamed narrator riffs on a vision of the dead moving through Waterloo Station. Every other story here makes a permanent dent in a reader's consciousness because of Mantel's striking language and plot twists, as well as the Twilight Zone-type mood she summons up. Mantel is drawn to grotesque characters and surreal situations, even when writing, as she does here, of the modern world. In an eerie story called Comma, for instance, two grubby little girls spend their summer vacation spying on a nearby mansion where something wrapped in a blanket is wheeled out on the patio for air every afternoon. That blanketed something, a deformed child perhaps, is shaped like a comma, and in an effort to see if it talks, one of the girls throws a rock at its face. Looking back on their actions years later, the more sensitive of those girls is baffled. She says, "If you spent your time trying to understand what happened when you were 8 and your friend was 10, you'd waste your productive years in plating barbed wire." Who else writes in such images? Images that at once stop a paragraph in its tracks and also advance our psychological understanding of what's going on. Mantel's curious metaphors and violent verbs are themselves things of beauty. A noisy air conditioner is said to be rattling away like an old relative with a loose cough. A nervous taxicab passenger remarks on a seatbelt sawing into her throat. A meaty meal kept warm for a wandering husband is described as a brown dinner that shriveled to a stain in its oven-proof serving dish. In what I think of as the best story in this collection, the one called How Shall I Know You?, a woman pulls up at a hotel which doesn't quite measure up to its glossy brochure. She comments to herself, "What I had taken to be stucco was in fact some patent substance newly glued to the front wall. It was grayish white and crinkled, like a split open brain or nougat chewed by a giant." That story starts out as a witty farce about a writer who accepts an invitation to lecture on her books at a book club in some dismal burg. But it curls round into something richer and stranger altogether, a chill meditation on the hierarchy of pity. A writer would have to be in absolute control of her language in order to successfully pull off an assassination fantasy featuring a recent real-life public figure, which is, of course, what the title story here is. Our female narrator recalls how, in August of 1983, she foolishly opened the door to a man she thought was a plumber. Instead, he's an assassin who wants to use her kitchen window to take aim at the then prime minister. The tone is at once droll and terrifying. Mantell is playing around with the theme of choices or doors that people walk through in life. She's also explicitly venting her rage at Thatcher. That she manages to do all this, juggle the metaphorical meditations and political commentary in a darkly comic short story, is breathtaking, which is the word I'd use to describe this collection.
Maureen Corrigan is the author of the new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher by Hilary Mantel. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
How many movies can pull off being both earnest and ironic, both cynical and romantic, and laugh-out-loud funny? I can only think of one, The Princess Bride. For many of you, I know those lines are already running through your head.
Marriage. Marriage is what brings us together.
Hello!
My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
As you wish.
Oh, my sweet Wesley, what have I done?
Cary Elwes played young, sweet Wesley. 27 years after The Princess Bride hit theaters, he has a new book about the making of the film. Of course, it's called As You Wish. We started talking about his most difficult scene. The story called for the greatest sword fight in modern times. And director Rob Reiner insisted that Elwes and Mandy Patinkin, who played Inigo Montoya, actually be in every frame of the scene, all while delivering that classic banter.
You're using Bonetti's defense against me, huh?
I thought it fitting, considering the rocky terrain.
He assigned to us two of the greatest sword trainers we could possibly get. And they worked us every single day. I mean, if there was time between a take, even. So we never had a chance to sit down on the movie, Mandy and I.
This was the last thing you filmed, almost, because it was so complex.
Right. Bob said to us at the beginning, he said, we've deliberately asked the producers to move the schedule of the sword fight sequence to the end of the movie because we need every day we can get with you just to teach you to do right-handed sword. Forget the left-handed. That's going to be a whole other thing.
Because halfway through the duel, both of you reveal that you're actually right-handed.
We're actually right-handed, moment. Correct.
There's something I ought to tell you.
Tell me. I'm not left-handed either.
I mean, I got to tell you, we really worked hard at it, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, speaking of that, there are a lot of funny people, a lot of funny scenes in this film. Was there one in particular where you had the hardest time keeping it together not cracking up?
Oh, my God. Well, it has to be Billy Crystal. I mean, there's no question.
Miracle Max.
I mean, forget it.
We need a miracle. It's very important.
Look, I'm retired.
And you had to play dead.
I had to play dead. I heard Rob go over to Billy. I remember him saying to him, yeah, just go for it. And he basically gave Billy free rein to do medieval Yiddish stand-up and throw away all the pages for the scene.
Sir, we're in a terrible rush.
Don't rush me, sonny. You rush a miracle, man, you get rotten miracles.
And then he walked over to me and he said, now listen, you have to be dead in this scene, so you can't. We can't even see you breathe, we can't see your chest move.
Hello in there! Hey, what's so important? What you got here, that's worth living for.
First person to be banned from the set because his laugh is so loud is Rob. Then I lost it, and so they replaced me with my rubber dummy. And then Mandy had tried so hard to hold in his laugh, he actually bruised a rib.
He didn't get hurt in the sword fight.
Didn't get hurt anywhere during the filming other than trying to hold in his laugh with Billy Crystal.
It's funny often with classic films when you get the backstory, you hear horrible stuff. It's like Singing in the Rain. They were all miserable the entire
really?
Time.
Or, were they really?
Well, yeah, apparently
no.
it was pretty
God,
tough
going.
I love
going. That movie.
But this, it sounds like you guys were just having a blast.
Oh, it was more fun than you think. We had an incredible director in Rob. He knew we were going on this journey, and he wanted to make sure he surrounded himself with people that he wanted to spend time with and have fun with. And that's what he got.
Now, a lot of the younger fans of the film probably aren't aware that this was not a huge blockbuster success at the time. I mean, I was in high school when it came out. I didn't even remember seeing trailers or ads for it. I saw
they
it on
pulled
video.
The trailer. Fox pulled the trailer. They would actually stump the marketing department, God bless them, because they'd never come across a film that had so many genres in it. You know, was it a comedy? Was it an adventure film? Was it a kids' film? Was it a fairy tale? Was it an adult movie? And, of course, it was all these things, you see. And they didn't know how to pitch it. The film came and did some modest business, respectable, modest, but not the kind of money that they'd hoped. And it wasn't until about almost a decade later when VHS came out that the film found its legs again. From a film that had been mostly dead, it was suddenly alive again, and then it became this huge hit.
When did you start to get a sense then that this was a very special film to a lot of people?
I was in a restaurant in New York, and I was ordering, I think, a hamburger, and the waitress said, "How do you want that done?" And I said, "Medium rare." And she said, "As you wish." And I looked up at her and I went, "What did you just say?" And she winked and walked off, and I thought, oh. And so it was a wonderful, delightful rebirth, if you will.
And you found out that Bill Clinton was a fan. And I bring this up because I know you do a good Bill Clinton impression.
That was amazing. I got to go to the White House. I worked on a show called From the Earth to the Moon, which Tom Hanks produced for HBO.
About the Apollo, the moon
Apollo
missions.
Space program, yeah. For the Millennium series at the White House, the president screened our episode, Apollo 11. And so we flew out to Washington, and finally we found ourselves standing in front of him, my wife and I. And I put out my hand, and I said, "Mr. President, my name is..." And he stopped me, and he goes, "I know exactly who you are, Carrie." And I thought, wow, how does he know me? This is crazy, you know? I mean, you know, I was in the movie, sure, but... And he goes, no, it's not what you think. Chelsea and I are big fans of The Princess Bride. We've seen it over 100 times. I know every line. I love that movie. And I just was dumbfounded. I couldn't believe it. There you go. You never know where your fans are going to be.
Carrie Elwes, his new book is called As You Wish. It's about the making of The Princess Bride. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I have to ask, can you just give us an As You Wish before
sure.
we go?
Sure. As You Wish.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Every sitcom on TV today lives in the shadow of Norman Lear. Not only did he pretty much create the modern TV sitcom, he showed its potential to do a lot more than just make people laugh. Name a sensitive social issue. Odds are, one of the Norman Lear comedies took it on. He also created more roles and opportunities for African Americans on TV, with shows like Good Times, The Jeffersons, and Sanford and Son. Lear credits that to growing up Jewish in America and feeling like an outsider himself.
What I experienced as a kid had a deep, profound, and constant influence on me. I saw myself as a member of a minority, had great empathy for myself, and then it flowed into other minorities who had more severe problems than I did.
Lear's new memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience. And what a life! On top of the backstory to all that great TV, we learn about his combat experience in World War II and growing up in a family that was more outrageous than anything he put on television. Lear actually spent several years living with cousins when his father went to jail for white-collar crime.
I can't get past calling him a rascal. I mean, he stole, he lied, he cheated. But that is so uncomfortable for me to think about. I rather think of him as a rascal.
And your mother's quite a character as well. It's kind of unbelievable to me how her reactions to your accomplishments are kind of meh.
She never saw me as anything past 9 years of age, I think. The best thing she could say about me was I used to like falling down the stairs to make people laugh.
Obviously, that didn't affect your confidence. Where does that come from?
Can you say beats the shit out of me on NPR?
Sure, we can bleep you. It's fine.
Okay. But you can bleep it in a way that you know I said it, won't you?
Absolutely. Let's go right to All in the Family, because that's a show that's such an important part of American culture. I thought I'd heard all the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff. I had no idea, though, how difficult it was for you getting that on the air.
Well, it took 3 years or a little more to get it on the air. I made it for one network, ABC. There were only three at the time. I made it for ABC originally. They wouldn't put it on and couldn't jettison it. So they used the contract to ask me to make a second show a year later. I didn't change the script. I just simply did it again. Same leads, Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton. And they again didn't put it on, but this time they lost it. And a year later, CBS had a new executive, and he wanted a brand that would feel like him, and he picked up All in the Family.
And even CBS, though, they were nervous and second-guessing right up until seconds before it went on the air.
Yes, yeah. There was one line. Archie and Edith come in from church when they're not expected because Archie didn't care for the sermon, and they left. And Mike and Gloria in the house alone have decided to go upstairs. And
they're the young newlyweds.
Yeah, the young newlyweds, yeah.
But we have to be downstairs to yell surprise.
They'll be downstairs. Let them yell surprise.
And Archie comes in.
Hi.
You're early.
Archie sees what they were, knows basically what they were up to, and says...
11:10 of a Sunday morning.
11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. They wanted that line out. And when I said, but why? Well, because he's putting his finger on what they were doing. I mean, 11 o'clock on a Sunday, what else? Well, I said, well, what's the problem with that? They're a married couple. Nothing happened. The camera saw nothing. And they were still. Can't do it, can't do it. I just had a sense that if they won this battle, which was almost silly, that would dictate the nature of the show, and I couldn't do that. So I said, clearly, if that goes on the air, or do the show without me. And it went on the air, and believe me, no state seceded from the Union. America lived with it.
Well, what about, like, you know, beyond worrying about particular lines, explain the pushback more broadly. What was it that was making ABC at first and then other people uncomfortable about this program?
Well, they were listening to an American bigot.
Archie Bunker.
They were listening to Archie Bunker. They had not heard those attitudes expressed, although you could hear them on a playground anywhere in America. I mean, it was no big deal. I'm saying that now with hindsight because we went on the air and... the first show, because they were so fearful, they had hundreds of telephone operators, literally, ready to go to pick up the phone calls, the complaints. And it wasn't enough to trouble six operators. So America, you know, was living what they knew very well because Archie Bunker's lived next door or right in the house with them.
If you had to do a TV show today, what would it be? Do you have a pitch?
Yeah, I would wish to get the generations below mine and mine, you know, from 55 or 60 up on television. I love Betty White, but she does not make a full demographic. Certainly, they're the fastest growing demographic with the most expendable income. There's every reason in the world for a show to exist. Ask me the title of what I want to do.
What's the title of what you want to do?
Guess Who Died? The script exists if anybody's interested in putting it on.
Is there a Norman Lear character in there?
Is there a Norman Lear character in there? There's a Norman Lear character spread thinly in all of them, I guess. That's what I found in writing the book.
That's Norman Lear, writer and producer behind All in the Family and way too many great shows to name. His new memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience, and it's out on Tuesday. Norman Lear, it's been really wonderful speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There are people who appreciate a good meal. There are people who are really into food. And then there's Dan Pashman. He doesn't call himself a foodie. He's an eater, and he's set out on a mission to help the rest of us eat better. I'm not talking about eating healthier here. Better, as in how to get the most deliciousness, to use his word, out of every single bite. Dan Pashman shares that wisdom in a new book called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. He joins us from our studios in New York. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Rachel.
You and I have had conversations about food before, and our Weekend Edition listeners are familiar with your food philosophy. But for the uninitiated, how about just explaining how you think about food?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that I consider a bite to be a precious resource. You know, like, you only get so many. You only get so many in every meal and in every life. And so you should strive to make every single one as delicious as possible. And I mean everyone, even if it's the most pedestrian meal, even if it's just that sandwich you grabbed at the lunch counter in your 5-minute break, there's probably something you can do to make it a little bit better. And I think that when you can do that, that's an exciting, fun, delicious moment. Like, you can achieve greatness even in the most modest culinary circumstances.
These are big promises that you've laid out, achieving greatness.
That's right.
So let's break this down. You have written this book with a lot of technical explanations about getting the most pleasure from your food. Let's walk through a couple of these. First off, the sandwich. There's a lot to say about this, but
there
you...
is. I don't know how much time we have for this interview, Rachel, but you might need to blow out the rest of the show.
Let's narrow it down to one aspect. You say construction of a sandwich is really actually very important.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Rachel, this has probably happened to you. You spend time building a beautiful sandwich, or you order a beautiful sandwich and it comes to you looking pristine and you are so excited to eat it, and you pick it up and you chomp your teeth into it. And what's the worst possible thing that could happen in that moment?
The insides fall out.
That's right.
Oh, really? Oh, I got an answer.
Yeah. I mean, these things keep me awake at night. But there are ways to avoid that cruel fate. And one is to give a lot of thought to the interior layering of your components and watch out for slippery components like sliced cucumbers, tomatoes, and avocados. I've identified this as something called the sliced cucumber conundrum.
So do you recommend keeping those ingredients off a sandwich?
Well, no. There's a few things you can do. You can use a technique I call the silver lining of greens, where you spread the greens, thin layers of greens, between each layer to create friction. But the other thing to take into account is the hardness or crustiness of the bread. Because the more bite force that's required to pierce the outside of the sandwich, the more pressure you're exerting on the inside. So if you're going to have very slippery interior ingredients, you want softer bread.
All right. I'm with you. Next up, situational eating.
Yes.
Some advice on how to eat well at work is something you explore in this book. What are the pitfalls?
Well, the pitfalls, I mean, the first pitfall of eating at work is we've all been in that situation. 3 or 4 o'clock rolls around and you're feeling a little sleepy, and you head for some sugar in the form often of the office vending machine.
Yes.
Which can be, for many people, a bleak place to end up at 3 or 4 o'clock. But I think that even that seemingly bleak moment, you know, like, there's an opportunity there to do something fun and creative and find deliciousness. For instance, there's a recipe in the book for something called Cube Farm Tiramisu, which is a technique where you just take cookies from your office vending machine, uh-huh, soak them in the free office coffee, lay them on a platter, and refrigerate it for a bit. You could add some whipped cream if you want to get fancy, but it's really pretty delicious. It works especially well with like an Oreo or something with a cream filling.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's Cube Farm Tiramisu. I also have a whole vending machine decision tree in the book to help you decide what you want out of your vending machine in the office at a given time.
And what about on airplanes, which is a difficult situation to derive pleasure from food?
It is. You know, it's interesting. They've done studies that your taste buds are 30% less sensitive when you're in an airplane cabin because the air is so dry there that your taste buds dry up. So the first thing you got to do is add more flavor. So
you're talking about bringing your own food, first off, necessarily.
That's right. I mean, look. If you really want to travel well, bring food from outside the airport because, you know, it's slim pickings once you cross through security. But if you're in the plane, uh-huh, and you didn't get a chance to grab that sandwich, I think there's a couple of things you could do. One is to just always travel with what I call an in-flight saucetation device.
Okay, what
which is
that?
Like, you know those little plastic 3-ounce bottles that you can buy at the pharmacy? They're like for shampoo or conditioner, the
yeah,
travel bottles.
Yeah.
Buy those. But instead, fill them with like sriracha, honey, soy sauce, hot sauce.
That is brilliant.
Throw them in your carry-on, and now you can just amp up whatever subpar meal they give you. The other thing is that while you're in the air, your taste bud sensitivity is reduced, but crunch sensitivity is increased. So crunchy foods taste crunchier when you're on a plane.
Is that for real?
Yes, the crunch will ring in your ears. It has to do with the hum of the airplane and the way that you process the sounds in your head. And so like when you get those free pretzels in the plane, if you're on a long flight and you're going to get a meal later, take the pretzels and save them and then crumble them over the entree. And that adds salt and flavor
salt,
and crunch.
A vehicle for salt. They never give me enough salt in those little packets.
That's what the pretzels are for.
Okay, so we've learned a lot here in this conversation. Any parting words of wisdom?
I mean, I talk in the book about how I feel like all of us have a lab in our own home, and it's called the kitchen. And there's great opportunity to experiment and try new things, and it's okay to fail as long as you're always striving for the platonic ideal of perfect deliciousness. And I think that's a noble quest. And I do honestly think, like, I think it's easy to dismiss all this as trivial. And certainly, you know, the book is fun and I hope that people find it entertaining. But I do think, like, I'm a big proponent of just the simple pleasures of life. And eating is one of the great universal simple pleasures. And when I wake up in the morning, no matter how crummy my day may look, if I got a good meal or two to look forward to, you know, the sun's shining.
There you go. Dan Pashman is the host of WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful. His new book is called Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Dan, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rachel.
Happy eating.
You too.
Kids love a good alphabet book. A is for apple, or for the more adventurous, A is for aardvark. But what if each letter had not just a word and a picture, but a whole story? So instead of C is for cat, how about this?
C, cup in the cupboard. Cup lived in the cupboard. It was dark and cold in there when the door was closed. He dreamed of living over by the window where he'd have a clear view. One afternoon, he decided to go for it. Unfortunately, he forgot that the counter was a long way down and made of concrete.
That's Oliver Jeffers, a kids' book writer and illustrator, whose new book is Once Upon an Alphabet, Short Stories for All the Letters. And, of course, the cup is cracked to pieces on the concrete in the end. Not a very cheery ending there for the cup.
Well, for a temporary spell, not a very cheery ending, but the cup does make an appearance later on in the book. The beautiful thing about a picture book is that it reading it aloud only shows or only presents half of the story. The other half is displayed in the pictures. So whenever we get to the Owl and the Octopus, the story simply says, out in the ocean, there is an owl who rides on the back of an octopus. They search for problems. They solve them. They move on.
The Owl and the Octopus, and they are recurring characters.
Are recurring characters, but that's simply all the words say. But then the pictures show the Owl and the Octopus solving a whole array of problems, from mathematical equations to gluing the cup back together.
When you say mathematical equations, you've got the quadratic formula in there from algebra.
Yeah, that's right.
Pretty
yeah.
Serious stuff there in the detail.
Well, you know, I don't like to just pick things at random. I like to have thought it through to the fullest possible extent.
Now, tell me about the genesis of this idea of the book about the alphabet and a story for each letter. What inspired it?
Well, the ideas came from all different places, really. Actually, that is what the idea is. It's a whole bunch of half-cooked ideas. I think what every really good story has is a beginning, a middle, and an end. And a lot of ideas that I've had have had either a beginning or a middle without an end, or a beginning and an end without really a middle. And so I would put all these concepts, these nuggets of ideas into my sketchbook, and there they would live until either they clash with another idea at another time and the explosion created a third idea, or they would just live there.
Now, we've mentioned the owl and the octopus, the problem-solving pair, the owl and the octopus, who are the O story. Another favorite of mine, though, is the S story, and I wonder if you could read that one for us.
I certainly can. S, sink or swim. This is the story of a regular cucumber who watched a program about sea cucumbers and thought it might be a better life for him. That very evening, the regular cucumber went to the shore and, taking a last look around, plunged into the sea. However, never having tried before, he hadn't realized he couldn't swim and sank straight to the bottom. He hasn't been heard from since. But don't worry, the owl and the octopus are on their way.
A good old owl and the octopus. He did as badly as the cup did there, the cucumber.
He did, but actually that's one of the stories that gets solved earlier on in the book whenever the owl and the octopus have a double-page spread of solving multiple problems. They say, there it is, and they're pointing to this strange green shape underwater, and it's the sea cucumber that they have found. or rather, the regular cucumber that's trying to be the sea cucumber.
Did you do this, by the way, A to Z, or were there some letters that came a lot more easily than others and some that gave you trouble?
The only stories that have remained pretty much true to the original are A, the astronaut story at the very beginning, mm-hmm. and then its bracket at the end with the Zeppelin, and then the octopus story. And I think every other story has had several reincarnations because they all had to flow together, and there were various things that I would consider. So I would write all of them, and then I would leave it for a couple of weeks and go back and read it with fresh eyes. And with fresh eyes, it was pretty obvious which ones weren't up to scratch, which ones weren't going to work. Some were tricky, yeah. Q was one of the trickiest ones because mm-hmm. There's not a lot of things you can do with stories with words beginning with Q, which is why I ended up going for a bit of a conundrum with that one. It's really a question rather than a story.
Yeah. Q, this story is supposed to be about a question, but I can't find it anywhere. Do you know where it is? That's the Q. There you go.
See, the interesting thing is kids get that immediately, but most adults I show to, they're like, I don't get it. They don't understand that the very last question is the question that they were looking for.
Well, Oliver Jeffers, thanks a lot for talking with us about your book.
Thanks very much, Robert.
It's a picture book called Once Upon an Alphabet, Short Stories for All the Letters. We'll be right back.